Gospel of Luke chapter 22, and we'll begin our reading in verse 31. And looking forward to the fellowship afterwards, but thankful for the word of God and the ability to preach it. And the Lord said, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." And he said unto him, "Lord, I am ready to go with thee, both into prison and to death." And he said, "I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." And he said unto them, "When I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, lacked ye anything?" And they said, "Nothing." Then said he unto them, "But now, he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say unto you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me." And he was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. And they said, "Lord, behold, here are two swords." And he said unto them, "It is enough." And he came out and went, as he was wont, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at that place, he said unto them, "Pray that ye enter not into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed, saying, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. When he rose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow, and said unto them, "Why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest ye enter into temptation." And while he yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. Jesus said unto him, "Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss?" When they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, "Lord, shall we smite with the sword?" And one of them smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And Jesus answered and said, "Suffer ye thus far." And he touched his ear and healed him. And then Jesus said unto the chief priests and captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him, "Be ye come out as against a thief with swords and staves? When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour in the power of darkness." Then took they him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And Peter followed afar off. When they had kindled a fire in the midst of the hall and were set down, Peter sat down among them. But a certain maid beheld him as he sat by the fire and earnestly looked upon him and said, "This man was also with him." And he denied him, saying, "Woman, I know him not." And after a little while another saw him and said, "Thou art also of them." And Peter said, "Man, I am not." And about the space of an hour after, another confidently affirmed, saying, "Of a truth, this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean." And Peter said, "Man, I know not what thou sayest." And immediately, while he yet spake, the cock crew. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he said unto him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." And Peter went out and wept bitterly. There's a lot in this passage, and we're certainly not going to cover all of it this morning, but I hope to cover a few things that I think will help us as we prepare for the temptations that we face in our lives. Let us go before the Lord in prayer. Father, I come before you. I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for your word. I pray, Father, for the strength to preach that word with power this morning. I know, Father, Lord, that no matter what I have prepared, if your spirit is not present, it will not touch the hearts of those here. I pray for your power, Father, Lord, but I pray for you to do a work in the lives of each one here, that your word would not return void. In Christ's precious name I pray, amen. Please be seated. It has often been said that to fail to prepare is to prepare to fail. I'm not sure who first said this. The basic idea has been given in many different forms, in many different settings, by many different people. But it's certainly a true statement. faulty preparation based on an inadequate understanding of the challenge ahead is no better. It does not matter if you plan, it does not matter if your plan for being prepared makes sense to you. If you've not accurately understood the challenge that you're facing, you have still prepared to fail. So if you fail to prepare, then you prepare to fail. And if you prepare for the wrong thing, then you've still prepared to fail. The second lesson is one that I had reinforced in my own life just a few short weeks ago, as most of you here already know. I had a plan, or so I thought, for climbing the mountain at the base of which our family camp was located. I had, or so I thought, everything that I needed to accomplish the climb. I had 3 bottles of water and a snack, and I even had someone that was going to go with me. Confident in my ability to swiftly climb and return, I set out to conquer the mountain, or so I thought. It didn't take me too long to realize that the task would prove more difficult than I had anticipated. I had overestimated how in shape I really was, and underestimated the effect that altitude would have on the conditioning that I actually did have. I began to move considerably slower than I had planned and drank more of my water than I should have at that point. The person that was with me had to go down the mountain because of a prior commitment, and what I ought to have done is returned with him and went back to the camp. But I was determined that I was going to make it to the top. I was going to accomplish what I set out to accomplish, regardless of how difficult it proved. Even though I was moving a bit slower than I planned, I had not even halfway up the mountain, I was getting text messages on my phone from days ago because there's no cell service at the camp. So I had in my head the idea that if I get to the top of the mountain, then I'll have cell service and I can call and let everyone know that I'm running late. So I don't need to worry about that either. So that was part of my plan, and this plan was developing and getting worse and worse as I went up the mountain. Continuing to guzzle my limited supply of water, I pressed on. I was not as far up the mountain as I had thought that I was, and it took longer than I planned to reach the top. Yet I was still more frustrated than worried. Though I had planned on being back at 4:30 to go on a walk with my family, I didn't think, and here was another part of my bad plan, I didn't think that anyone would really get worried unless I missed dinner set up at 5:30. So I thought I had until then. That was also an incorrect thought. It was not until about 4:15 that I finally made it to the top and started back down the mountain. I'd finished all 3 of my water bottles, I'd long since burned up all of my energy, and yet I was counting on a quick descent. I was going to get down very quickly, confident in my ability to go back down the way I came much faster than I had come up. I was wrong again. I took a bit of a turn, only a small one at first, but it was enough to take me down the left side of the mountain, a side that is over 4 times as long as the face that I went up. Time began to pass rapidly as I struggled, increasingly dehydrated by this point, down the mountain. I pushed harder and harder, hoping to be back by 5:30, wondering how I was ever going to be able to help set up a dinner haul in my increasingly filthy state as I slid down the mountain. But I was hoping that I was going to be back before anyone got too worried. I ended up in a seemingly endless thicket of young trees that had grown together where I could see nothing at all and could barely move at all. And my progress predictably didn't increase in that thicket. It was at this point that I began to realize just how badly I had overestimated my preparedness for the challenge that I had tackled. By the time I finally got to the base of the mountain, it was well after 6:00. And due to my left turn at the top, I was still a considerable way away from the camp. Fortunately, I was picked up by some of those who had long since been looking for me and returned safely to camp. As I returned, I was informed that a full-on search and rescue operation had already been underway for some time, a good while before I had even thought anyone would be worried about me. By the time I got to the base of the mountain, I knew people would be looking for me, but I had no idea just how long they had been looking for me. I had inconvenienced almost everyone in camp, except perhaps some very small children who appreciated the excitement. I was and still am mortified and embarrassed by the inconvenience that I caused everyone and by the worry that I gave to my dear wife and to everyone else. I thought that I was prepared for the challenge that I had set myself of climbing the mountain. Yet the data on which I made that judgment were wrong from beginning to end. I thought I had a good plan, But I planned on a bunch of faulty information. And my plan, like we talked about in the children's program, my plan stunk badly. No matter what plans I thought I had made, I was just as unprepared as if I had made no plans at all. It does not matter how much attention you devote to preparation if you prepare for the wrong thing or prepare in the wrong way. Preparation is essential. The right kind of preparation is essential to prevent failure, but not just any kind of preparation will do. An athlete that doesn't prepare off the field is going to be an utter failure on the field. So if you do no training and no conditioning, many of the young men in the church are in rugby, and if they did no workouts and no training at all, they would fail miserably when they got on that rugby field. At the same time, it doesn't matter how much an athlete trains if they train for the wrong sport. The type of muscle strength demanded by powerlifting will not be of great help to a marathon runner. In fact, it may even slow them down. Perfecting one's ability to pitch a curveball will not get you very far when it comes to achieving a jiu-jitsu championship. Maybe the general conditioning will help, but in terms of actually getting very far, it will not help at all. If you want to be ready for any but the most elementary of challenges, focused preparation is indispensable. The same reality applies to every area of life, and we could spend a lot of time on this, but we won't. Just one more example. A talented musician may be able to pick up a new instrument with relative ease and strum a few chords and play through a song, especially if it's similar to an instrument that they've played before. But genuine mastery of that instrument is achieved only by focused preparation. Enthusiasm is a wonderful thing, but it is never a substitute for diligent preparation. This is something that all of us, at least at some level, recognize. Even when we try to skate by in a particular area without adequate preparation, we recognize, at least in retrospect, we recognize when we've seen the bad consequences of trying to do that, that there really is no replacement for adequate and accurate preparation. Yet so often, while we recognize the importance of preparation for sports or music or academics or so many other areas, we can be tempted to apply a different standard to the spiritual warfare that all believers are engaged in. We know or should know that difficult tasks of every kind require prior preparation, and to fail to devote time to that prior preparation is to fail to perform a task of any difficulty. No reasonable person would be able to perform the difficult sequences of a Chopin concerto solely based on a sincere desire to do so. I'm going to sit down at the piano and I want to play like they play in Carnegie Hall, but it's not going to happen. For me, it will never happen, no matter how much I prepare. But no matter how talented you are as a musician, you're not going to be ready to perform a concert in Carnegie Hall on the basis of your talent and enthusiasm alone. Concentrated and focused preparation will be demanded. Such a challenge demands focused preparation by even the most talented of musicians. No reasonable person would expect to be able to deadlift 500 pounds on their first ever day of strength training. Even when by trying to do things we haven't prepared for, we don't put this knowledge into practice. So we would recognize that those are extreme cases. But even when by trying to do things we haven't prepared for, we don't put this knowledge into practice. So sometimes we try to do things we haven't prepared for. We get the concept when it comes to the challenges of this present life. Yet when we consider the challenges of the Christian life, it is all too easy to apply a different standard. We are constantly tempted to think that as long as we have a sincere desire to make the right decision, we are adequately prepared for whatever temptations we will face. Just as I underestimated the preparations necessary to climb a mountain without causing anyone significant distress, so all of us are tempted to underestimate the preparation that we need to make it through the Christian life without failing in ways that bring destruction to ourselves and to others. And that miscalculation can cause considerably more devastation. This temptation is not unique to us. It is one that has been faced by every generation of believers. And in the text that we read, it was a temptation that was faced by the Apostle Peter. Jesus warned Peter of the trial that lay ahead of him. He warned Peter that danger was coming. Satan desired to sift all the disciples. If you go back to verse 31, Jesus said, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat." The you that Satan desires is all of the disciples. But it's a plural you. But Peter is the leader of the disciples, and Satan in particular is desiring to pick him to pieces, to use an idiom that we use today. The devil is out to get him as the leader of the disciples. He is a prime target. Just as a head of grain was broken into pieces by the sifting of a grain sieve, Satan wanted to pick Peter to pieces. Of course, even as he was giving this warning, so Jesus knew he was giving this warning to Peter, and Jesus knew that Peter was not going to heed the warning. He knew the failure was going to come into Peter's life, and so he gave him the encouragement ahead of time that his failure would not be final. He would return from his failure to strengthen his brethren and to help them through his experience learn to avoid the mistakes that he had made. Jesus said in verse 32, "But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." I should note that when Jesus speaks here of Peter being converted, he isn't saying that Peter is not yet a believer, but simply speaking of Peter's turnaround from failure to continued faithfulness. The time, though, Peter didn't see Jesus' words as encouraging at all. So in retrospect, Peter would look back at verse 32 and be profoundly encouraged. But in the moment when Jesus was saying that, Peter did not feel encouraged at all. Peter was angry, as it turns out. Jesus was questioning his ability to stay faithful. Jesus was saying that there would come a time of failure in his life from which he would need to turn around. Was Jesus saying that he, Peter, the rock apostle, was going to abandon Jesus in the hour of danger? Jesus, Peter thought, was questioning his sincerity. Peter hastened to set the record straight. He assured Jesus he was willing to face anything rather than abandon Christ. He was no fly-by-night disciple, like maybe somebody else, like somebody else of the disciples. That wasn't what he was like. He was sincere. He was willing to undergo suffering, death even, rather than deny the Lord he loved so much. It's crucial to note that Jesus didn't go on to question the sincerity of Peter's passion. Peter's passion was transparently sincere. He knew Peter meant what he said. He knew that Peter had the sincere intention of doing exactly what he said he would do. But Jesus also knew that sincerity wasn't going to be enough for the time of trial that was coming in Peter's life. Jesus knew that Peter was going to face a trial in which sincerity wasn't going to be enough. He knew that Peter, as prepared as he thought that he was, had radically underestimated the challenge that he was about to face. He was not as prepared as he thought that he was. Jesus told Peter, no doubt in a voice laden with emotion, that before the morning came, he would have denied that he even knew Jesus no less than 3 times. But before Peter could continue his protest of sincerity, Jesus went on to warn all the disciples of the trials that lay ahead of them. These next few verses, verses 35 through 38, are somewhat difficult to interpret, and there have been many bizarre solutions put forward. And at first, Jesus seems to tell his disciples to buy swords at any cost. It seems a little confusing, especially when it's compared to the other things that Jesus had said before about taking up the sword and what he was about to tell them about using it just a few verses later. While other explanations are possible, the simplest understanding that coheres both with the context of this text in particular and the scope of Jesus' teaching as a whole, not coincidentally the one given by the majority of commentators, is that Jesus wasn't speaking of physical swords. He wasn't telling them to arm themselves for battle. If that was really his intention in these verses, it would be an intention that contradicted both his other instructions to his disciples, his claim to Pilate that his disciples, his kingdom was not of this world, his own practice, and the practice of the early church. Rather, what's going on here is just as he did in Matthew 16:12, when he told the disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, without first explaining he was actually talking about their doctrine, or John 2:19, talking about rebuilding the temple without previously explaining that he was talking about the temple of his body. He is here using the sword, the script, the shoes, and the purse to make a point about the difficulty of the trial that was going to come upon them. He was trying to give them a vivid picture of the reality that what they were about to face was harder than anything that they had faced before, and it was going to require a level of preparation that had never been required before. Just as the disciples had misunderstood what Jesus said about the leaven of the Pharisees by beginning to argue about their lack of physical bread, so they misunderstood what Jesus was trying to teach them by presenting him with two swords, one of which was to reappear shortly to Jesus' express condemnation. This time, though, unlike the occasion of the leaven of the Pharisees, there was not time for an extended explanation. They hadn't got the point, and now they were not going to get it until it was too late. Jesus told them, "It is enough." He wasn't saying they are enough, as if he thought that he was glad that they had two swords, and those two swords are enough swords for you all, and he thought that they were sufficient. It was instead a way to dismiss the conversation, to say, "Enough of this kind of talk. You're not understanding what I'm saying." The disciples didn't understand the spiritual realities Jesus was talking about, but now there was not time to elaborate further. He would instead show them how to prepare for the spiritual conflict that lay ahead of them. Peter thought that because he was sincere in his desire to follow Jesus, regardless of the cost, he wasn't really in the danger that Jesus said that he was. Jesus was about to show his disciples that no one, no matter how sincere or spiritual or dedicated or intelligent or knowledgeable or whatever, is above the need for preparation for the spiritual warfare that lies ahead of us. He was also about to show them what real preparation looks like. Jesus was and is both perfect God and perfect man, the infinite power of the Godhead united to a full and complete human being, yet without sin. Yet he, knowing what was coming, took the time to pray, to submit to the will of the Father, and to be strengthened. He did not go to the cross unprepared. He told his disciples that they too needed to pray in preparation for the hour of temptation that was about to come upon them. He knew that even though they all, no less than Peter, sincerely desired to follow Jesus, their sincerity without preparation would not be enough. Prayer is both the expression and the source of the dependent humility that alone prepares us for the trials that we are guaranteed to face in this life. As we spend time in prayer, our need for further dependence is revealed. God's grace, as Paul said, is made perfect in weakness, not in strength. It is only when we are weak before God that we can be strong before men and strong in the face of the adversary. Jesus showed his disciples, both by example and command, that only the dependent watchfulness that comes through humble and broken prayer can prepare us to stand in the hour of temptation. They did not get the message. Worn out by grief and confusion by all that had been said and done that night, they fell asleep when they should have prepared. And then the time of preparation was over. The betrayer was present, and the moment of truth had arrived. The test had come, and they had not studied. Judas had arrived with the multitude. I'm sure that the disciples were disappointed in themselves for being asleep when Jesus came back. Because they had failed to prepare, they didn't even realize how unprepared they actually were. And so they grossly misjudged the situation. They immediately thought back to the two swords that they had shown to Jesus and asked him if now was the time to use them. Not receiving an answer, one of them, who we know from John to be Peter, decided to go ahead and use it. Jesus intervened, healed the damage from Peter's ineffectual swordsmanship, and put a stop to his efforts. Jesus was arrested, and Peter was left behind. Peter may have been frustrated with his sleepiness and his swordsmanship, but he still had a desire to stay close to Jesus. See, we have to get this. He really was sincere in his desire to follow Jesus, every bit and probably considerably more sincere than any of us are in our desire to follow Jesus. Peter really meant what he said. He may have followed from afar off, but we have to remember, he was following, apparently alone, a large group of armed men, and Jesus had forbidden him to use the only weapon that he had. Peter was not a coward. Not only did he follow, having been forbidden by Jesus to use his sword, a band of armed men who had little respect for the legality of their actions, but he snuck into the very courtyard of the house of the high priest where Jesus was being examined on trial for his life. In that day, large houses were built in a rectangle with a large open courtyard in the center. Peter was in the middle of Jesus' enemies. Jesus had said that Peter would deny him, but we have to look at this from Peter's perspective, not in retrospect looking back, but his perspective looking forward at the situation to realize how what was really going on here. Jesus had said, Peter, you're going to deny me, and here Peter is in the courtyard, sitting in the midst of the enemies of Jesus, still following Jesus. At least from Peter's perspective, he's still following Jesus. Jesus said, Peter, you're going to fail. And Peter is sitting there thinking to himself, no, I'm not going to fail. I'm still there. I can still do this. I've messed up to this point, but the game is not over. I'm going to stand. He still thought he was going to make it. I'm sure he was nervous, even terrified. But I also tend to think, though Scripture does not specifically say this, that he felt a little good about himself about now. Perhaps like I felt when I made it to the top of the mountain and thought that I still had enough time to make it down, little realizing that by that point people were already looking for me. Sure, he'd fallen asleep when he should have prayed. That stunk. He had botched his rescue job of Jesus. He thought he was going to fight off all those guys all by himself. He failed. That really stunk. But on the other hand, he was still there. He hadn't run away. Maybe a good rescue opportunity would turn up and Peter would be able to save the day and Jesus would know that he'd been wrong about Peter. Jesus would know that Peter was really as sincere as he said he was and he was willing to follow Jesus anywhere and Jesus would be grateful for Peter forever and somehow things would turn out all right and Jesus would be the king that Peter wanted him to be and things were just going to turn out and these are the kind of thoughts that Peter would have been having at this point. We think through it from his perspective looking forward, not his perspective looking back. Peter would do whatever it took to stay close, yet he still had no idea what he was up against. A servant girl interrupted his thoughts, staring at him and telling the others that this man, he's one of Jesus' disciples. Without thinking, Peter quickly denied that he knew Jesus. It was a lie, sure, but it was a lie in a good cause. He had to stay to the end, and he wouldn't be of any use if they arrested him, too. He had to stay and try to protect Jesus and try to stay there, and if they dragged him away somewhere else, then he wouldn't be with Jesus anymore. He would do whatever it took to stay with Jesus. Then someone else, this time a man, pointed Peter out. Peter quickly, this time emphatically, denied it. After some time passed, a third person, this time confidently, told the others that Peter had been with Jesus and pointed out that his accent and attire gave him away. Desperate and pressured, Peter broke down completely and began to vehemently deny that he knew anything at all about Jesus. From the other Gospels, we know that he even began to use profane language and to curse and to swear. He no longer had any thought but how to get out of the situation he placed himself in, no matter what he had to say or do. In the heat of the moment, he would say things he never would have thought he would say. He didn't even realize what he was saying until it was forever too late to take the horrible words back. Even while he was carrying on like that, Peter heard the rooster crow. And then Jesus turned and looked at him. All at once, the reality of what had just happened flooded Peter's mind and soul. He left the courtyard, went out into the dark, and began to sob bitterly. Took a few liberties in my telling of this part of Peter's story. Scripture doesn't tell us exactly what Peter was thinking as he stood by that fire in the courtyard of the high priest. On the other hand, it does make it quite clear what Peter wasn't thinking. He wasn't thinking of the warning that Jesus had given him. He didn't think of that till the rooster crowed and he saw Jesus looking at him. Every indication in the text is that Peter was just as sincere in his desire to follow Jesus as he said that he was, yet his lack of preparation led to him being completely blindsided by the events that took place. Peter was looking to his own sincerity, his own desire to stand with Christ to protect him, and in the heat of the moment, he completely forgot the warning that he had been given until it was too late. Peter's sincere desire to follow Jesus without the dependent humility that watchful prayer alone can produce was insufficient preparation for the trials that he faced. Peter's sincere desire to follow Jesus without the dependent humility that watchful prayer alone can produce was insufficient preparation for the trials that he faced. It wasn't Peter's sincerity that was being tested. It was his preparation. Peter didn't even realize he was failing until it was too late. If you'd asked Peter in cold blood whether he would deny that he ever knew Jesus, he would have been angry with you. Angry with you. It would have been a heated conversation. He would have demanded to know, who do you think you are telling me something like that? Jesus told him that. And that's what he said to Jesus. What do you think he would say to you? What Peter didn't realize is that in the heat of the battle, our decisions are not based on our sincerity, but on our preparation. Without the dependent humility that watchful prayer alone can bring, he didn't even realize what was happening until it was too late. Peter would be restored in answer to Jesus' prayer. His faith would not fail in the end. But he would never forget that he had still done and said things that he had promised he would never do or say. He could and did move on, but he could never undo. I don't know what kind of temptations you face in your life now or will face in the future, but I do know that if you are a disciple of Jesus, if you're a believer, Satan wants to pick you to pieces just as much as he wanted to destroy the first disciples. He is a roaring lion, and he wants to devour you. Thank God if you are one of God's children. If you've been born again, you are not going to be devoured. You are not going to be utterly destroyed. But just because you will be spared from eternal ruin does not mean that you are safe from temporal failure. You too, just as Peter was, are going to be tempted to think that your sincere desire to make the right decision will be sufficient in the hour of temptation. Others may fail, but you, because of your sincerity, will not fail. Yet the reality is that sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. Sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. All of us are tempted to think that we have the resources within ourselves to resist the temptations that we will face. While we understand how important preparation is on the sports field, in the academic world, or in musical performance, we are tempted to think that a sincere desire to follow Jesus will be enough to keep us safe from moral failure. Yet sincerity without preparation is always insufficient to prevent failure. Without the dependent humility that watchful prayer both exemplifies and produces, we are in constant danger of being blindsided by a temptation that we never even see until it is too late. Preparation and prayer both reveals your weaknesses, and that changes both the way you think and the way you act. Realizing your weakness is what enables you to pay attention to the danger that is coming and to be able to withstand that danger. While there are often other things we can and even must do to protect against specific temptation safeguards we need to place in our lives, the perspective of humble dependence that watchful prayer alone can bring is always the foundation for adequate preparation for the spiritual battle that all of us face, regardless of the specific temptation and the way that it shows up in your life. This isn't about just praying, "Oh God, protect me from failure," and then carrying on as before. This is about spending enough time with God to alter your entire perspective of your own ability to stand. Without an accurate perspective, you are always in danger of being blindsided, no matter how sincere your intentions may be. As an old writer put it, weakness with watchfulness will stand, when strength with too much confidence faileth. Weakness with acknowledging of it is the fittest seat and subject for God to perfect his strength in, for consciousness of our infirmities driveth us out of ourselves to him in whom our strength lieth. I'll read the first part of that one more time because it's so good. Weakness with watchfulness will stand when strength with too much confidence faileth. It is only as we, through dependent prayer, confront ourselves with our own weakness that we can receive the strength that we need to overcome them. Peter didn't go into that courtyard intending to deny Jesus. In fact, he likely thought that he was going to prove just how loyal and faithful he really was, to prove that Jesus had been wrong about how weak he said Peter would be. His intentions were not the problem. It was his lack of preparation. He didn't see himself as weak, and he didn't see himself as dependent on the strength of the Father, and so he wasn't able to see the danger until he had already fallen prey to it. The same thing can happen to you, and the same thing can happen to me. If you do not have the perspective on your true weakness and your absolute dependence on the Father for strength that only watchful prayer can provide, you will likely never be given the chance to make a conscious decision at all. This is crucial. If you do not have a realization of your weakness, when the hour of temptation comes, it won't be a conscious decision. You won't have that moment to make a decision because your decision has already been made beforehand. Peter didn't wake up one morning and decide to deny that he knew Christ. He wasn't given 5 minutes to think about it. Think about it. Are you going to deny Christ or not? The temptation came like that. And his preparation determined his response. He stayed asleep one night thinking, perhaps even without a conscious decision, that his sincerity was a sufficient guarantee of his steadfastness. He didn't know what was happening until it was too late. The same thing could happen to any one of us here. Success or failure in the spiritual battle that we face is determined not by sincerity, but by prior preparation. Dependence is the only form of resistance that will prove effective in that day. Strength against this kind of foe is found only in weakness, and weakness, the right kind of weakness, will not happen by accident. We naturally think we are stronger than we really are. If you think that you are too strong to fail in a particular area, it is precisely in that area that you are setting yourself up to fail. There is no such thing as too big to fail in the Christian life. If we do not learn to see ourselves as weak, we are setting ourselves up to fall. Now, of course, we will not always fail in the same way or in the same areas. The temptations that you face may look very different from the ones that someone else will be confronted with. Yet any believer who fails to heed Jesus' warning to his disciples to watch and pray is setting themselves up for a major failure of some kind. It may not be a public failure. It may not be a failure that others are aware of, but it will be a failure that God is aware of. It could be a failure to restrain your temper or your tongue. While I doubt very much that anyone here would be arrogant enough to say that you would never say or do anything that you regret, that you have perfect control over your temper and your tongue, it is all too easy to think that our sincere desire to do right will keep us from ever doing anything really bad. We may lose our cool, but we think we are never going to really hurt somebody when we get angry. We're never going to say anything that will permanently destroy a relationship with someone. We may get frustrated. We may say a few things we shouldn't have said here or there, but we really can't see ourselves saying whatever really bad looks like in our situation. Peter couldn't either. He couldn't see himself denying Christ, but he did it anyway, and he did it precisely because he thought it would never happen to him. He thought he was strong enough to stand on his own, so he forgot to prepare to be dependent. What we must realize in every situation is that, but for the grace of God, there we go also. And when we look at the failures of others, we need to realize that apart from the grace of God, their failure could be our failure. We are not above failing. no matter how hard it may be for us to believe in the moment, just as Peter found it hard to believe that he would deny Christ. He didn't know what he would be faced with. But for the dependent watchfulness that only comes by prior preparation, the very best Christian in this room can find themselves saying things that, though they may be forgiven, will never be able to be taken back. Sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. It could be a failure in your financial ethics. You may be sitting here thinking that you would never steal money that didn't belong to you. You would never lie on your tax return. You would never do any of those things that you hear of other people doing. You don't know what temptations you're going to be faced with in the years to come. I don't either. But what I do know is that when your time for testing does come, it won't be announced ahead of time. You won't have a day to think about, do I really want to become a thief? It will come when you least expect it, with justifications that sound better than anything you could now imagine. And if you are not prepared, you will fail. And if you do not repent from that failure, you will start down a path that will lead you to things you never could have thought possible. You don't know what you are up against. The sincerity of your preparations is no guarantee of their sufficiency. It could be a moral failure. I don't think any believer here would set out with the intention of sexual sin of any kind. If you're married, I trust that you want to stay faithful to your spouse with your mind, with your heart, and with your body. If you are single, you have a sincere desire, or at least I trust that you do. If you're a believer, you have a sincere desire to avoid the slime pit of sexual corruption that saturates our society. Yet no matter how sincere your desire to be faithful and pure may be, sincerity of desire will never be enough to prevent failure. You simply do not know what temptations you are going to face. If you're confident in your ability to stand in your own strength, you are setting yourself up for a disastrous fall. I don't know what temptations you'll face, but I do know that they will be stronger than you ever thought they would be. It will be harder not to click on that pop-up window that you thought your filter would keep you from seeing than you thought it would be. A difficult season in your marriage could make flirtations at work that you would have scorned just a few weeks before seem alluring, even manageable and justifiable. If you're single, the thought of losing your significant other could be more difficult than you thought it would be, and you'll find yourself compromising purity in ways you would now swear are not even an option. Just as Peter swore he would never deny Christ, and yet found himself in a situation where it seemed the only option he had. You don't know what you're up against. If you think you are prepared, competent in your own strength to face the temptations that will come your way, you will not have the only preparation that really matters. Those who do not realize they are weak will never get the help that they need until it is too late. Only by the preparation that Jesus himself modeled, only by dependence, only by realizing our weakness and our need for strength will we be able to stand. It could be exactly the same kind of failure that Peter faced. We're facing an increasingly hostile society in which faithfulness to Christ is going to be more and more difficult. Whether through outright denial or compromising silence, we're going to be tempted that we really do know Christ or that we really are his disciples, that we really are those Christians that believe the Bible and don't think that we need to modify it to suit the norms of our culture today. Regardless of the setting, sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. Without a constant dependence on God, without a constant acknowledgement of weakness, we are in danger of being led down the path of failure without ever seeing the destination until it is too late. And we're thinking we're so good, we're going to avoid that failure, we're skirting around the obstacles, we're dancing in the minefields, we're going to succeed until we realize we've overestimated our ability. We've underestimated our need for dependence, and we failed in a way that will never be undone. Whether in one of these areas or in something entirely different, our greatest failures are failures of preparation, not sincerity. Peter didn't fail because he was wrong about his own sincerity. We have to realize that. Peter was every bit as sincere as he said that he was. Every bit as sincere as anyone in this room, and probably considerably more so. Peter failed because he didn't have the dependent humility that watchful prayer alone can produce. Because he didn't have that dependent humility. He didn't even see the danger until the cliff of danger until he was already on his way to the bottom. The same is true of us. Without the dependent humility that watchful prayer alone can produce, we will not even know what hit us. If this was the whole story, this message would be a somber one indeed. And indeed, this aspect of it should sober us. Yet there is something else. Our failure, like the failure of Peter, does not have to be permanent, which is a good thing, because as we go through that list of different things, I think all of us will realize that we have failed in large ways and small. Failure is something that everyone in this room has experienced both before and after salvation, and something in large and small ways that all of us will experience again. No matter how prepared we seek to be, there will come blind spots and areas that we have not adequately prepared to face. And the joy that we need to delight in is that even as Peter failed, Jesus was succeeding for him and for us. Peter may have failed to prepare. Peter may have been blindsided by the trial that he faced, but Jesus didn't fail to prepare, and Jesus wasn't blindsided by the trial that he faced. He wasn't blindsided by the cross. He knew what the will of the Father was, and he did the will of the Father, and he did the will of the Father for us and for all who will receive him. Even though Peter failed greatly, he did not fail finally. God's grace meant that Peter's failure wasn't final. Peter and the other apostles learned their lesson after Jesus rose from the dead. And over again in the book of Acts, we see the apostles preparing in prayer, acknowledging their own weakness and their total dependence on divine power to stand faithful in the face of the many obstacles that they faced. Whether you have already failed or are trying to pick up the pieces, or tempted to think that your sincerity alone will be enough to prevent failure, the answer is the same. The only way to prepare is also the only way to recover. And that way is to constantly turn to God in humble dependence and watchful prayer. You are not too busy to prepare. You are in too much danger not to prepare. A daily devotional walk with God is not optional for the believer. It is just as essential to the spiritual warfare that we are in as conditioning is to the athlete, practice to the musician, and study to the student, only the stakes are much higher. If you lose the game, your life is not over, contrary to how you may feel in the moment. If you botch your performance, your life will continue. The consequences are unlikely to be eternal. But if you fail in the spiritual battle, the devastation that it can bring to your life and to the lives of those who depend on you for leadership can be far-reaching indeed. Preparation is not optional. Sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. Sincerity without preparation will not prevent failure. Please stand with me. I'm going to go before the Lord in prayer, and after I do, there's going to be an opportunity to respond to the message. Father, I come before you this morning, and I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for your word. I thank you for the warnings of your word. I thank you for the promises of your word. I pray, Father, Lord, that we would delight ourselves in those promises and take heed to the warnings and spend the time in preparation that we need to prepare for the trials that will surely come. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.